Welcome to the Fredcast Cycling Podcast for the weeks of May 28th and June the 4th, 2012. My name is David, and I'm a Fred. In this week's episode of the Fredcast, a cyclist wins an around-the-world bike race in record time. New York City considers a mandatory helmet law for all cyclists. How the fear of dread can lead to increased cycling. And a cycling con man feeds on the generosity of other cyclists in Portland, Oregon. In pro cycling news, results from the Dauphiné and the USA Pro Road Championships, plus a new winner is announced in the 2010 Tour de France. In the features this week, listener feedback and questions, plus PodSafe cycling music. All that and more coming right at you in this week's episode of the Fredcast Cycling Podcast. So sit back, relax, and if you're riding your bike hammer, just a little bit harder, because here comes the Fredcast. Well, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and good night, fellow Freds. It's great to be back with you on another episode of the Fredcast Cycling Podcast. And wow, it seems like everybody, at least here in the Northern Hemisphere, is having great cycling weather. So I hope you've had the opportunity to get out and get on your bike, whether it's your road bike, your mountain bike, or hey, even your cyclocross bike. We're talking about a race coming up here in Park City this summer during dealer camp, a cyclocross race in the heat of the summer, one of the highest altitude races coming up. So get out on your bike and enjoy the great summer weather. And if you're in the Southern Hemisphere, I'm hoping that you're finding yourself some good winter cycling weather as well. Lots to talk to you about, as always, here on this week's episode of the Fredcast. But before we get started, I'd be remiss if I didn't have the opportunity to thank one of our sponsors, Jensen USA, at jensenusa.com/thefredcast. Jensen USA has an amazing selection and array of products to suit your cycling needs. Again, whether it's road, mountain, BMX, you name it, and whether we're talking about, well, winter, spring, summer, or fall, everything you need is at jensenusa.com/thefredcast. Not only are you going to find everything you need, but you're going to find it at unbeatable prices. And along with that legendary jensenusa.com customer support and service. Give you an example. I just placed an order myself from Jensen USA. Yes, I have to pay retail price as well. I just placed an order from Jensen USA, and I was so pleased with the selection of products that I had to choose from and with the speed with which the order was placed. Plus, I've been very impressed with the new Jensen USA website. We've been talking about it since the beginning of the year, and it's just so much easier to find things, and it just seems like everything is laid out right where I need it when I need it. So whether you are looking for something for your road bike, your mountain bike, your cyclocross bike, and everything in between, when you need a part, when you need a complete bike, head on over to jensenusa.com/thefredcast or click the jensenusa.com link on the right-hand side of the page at thefredcast.com. We thank jensenusa.com so much for their support of the Fredcast, and we thank you for your support of Jensen USA. Topping the news on this week's episode of the Fredcast is the story of 31-year-old Great Britain native Mike Hall, who just returned from traveling around the world. And well, unlike most British tourists who return from an around-the-world trip, Mike didn't return via airplane to Gatwick or Heathrow. He didn't return via Channel Tunnel, and he didn't return via steamship to Southampton. No, Mike returned to Great Britain via bicycle after having just won an around-the-world bicycle race in 92 days. As a matter of fact, Mr. Hall becomes the fastest person to navigate the globe by bicycle in just 92 days, beating the previous record by almost 2 weeks. The previous record was 106 days, 10 hours, and 33 minutes by Alan Bate, also a Brit. He himself cycling a distance of over 29,467 kilometers. Hall doing a 24,900-mile trip that saw him riding over 18,000 miles through 20 countries and across 4 continents. Hall was competing along with 10 other cyclists who left England on February 18th as part of the Quick Energy World Cycle Racing Grand Tour. Now, each of the cyclists involved in this event got to choose their own route around the globe, but they had to each travel a minimum of 18,000 miles on their bikes in the same direction, and their movements were constantly tracked by Global Positioning System receivers. Hall completed his leg of the race, his final leg of the race, on his birthday, with lots of family and friends coming out to see him cross the finish line. And Hall said, quote, "I think I had a lot of the emotions in the last few weeks on the roads. It was quite difficult, and I think it builds up the stress. So I kind of released all that in the last few days. Now I just feel pretty calm. There have been some moments, some kind of breakdowns, but," and I love this part, "I keep the breakdowns on the bike. I don't stop for those." According to Hall, the worst thing to happen to him during the race was when he rode into a hole in Albania, continuing, quote, "I broke my bike, but managed to fix it with some parts I had, then had to ride through the night to get to Greece. There were a few close calls with traffic, but I just tried to keep safe and keep vigilant." Among some of his favorite sights from the trip, he said, were the sea lions along the coast of California and the eagles that he had the opportunity to see in Turkey. Now, inevitably, when somebody completes an event like this, people always want to ask, is this something that you would do again? And he said that, quote, "I would definitely change parts of the route if I did it again," continuing, "but I'm not sure I would want to do it again, though." Well, congratulations to Mr. Hall on his circumnavigation of the globe and his setting of a new world record of circumnavigating the globe by bicycle in just 92 days. Over the last week or so here in the United States, New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg has been taking a lot of heat for his proposal to ban the sale of large soft drinks, large sugary soft drinks, within the city of New York, with a lot of critics complaining that it is not the city of New York's responsibility to be the parent of every single citizen or visitor of the city of New York. And a lot of people have complained that this is just another encroachment of the so-called nanny state. Well, it was interesting, therefore, to note that last week, City Council member David Greenfield in the city of New York introduced a law that would make wearing a helmet while riding a bicycle mandatory in New York City for all, whether they be children or adult bicycle riders, and that the law would make the failure to wear a bicycle helmet punishable by a $25 fine. When introducing the bill, Greenfield was quoted as saying, "The reality is 91% of cyclists who are killed are not wearing helmets. Seatbelt laws don't keep people from driving cars. Seatbelts save lives. In a way, not wearing a helmet is worse than not wearing a seatbelt. You're endangering your life, your family's lives, and the lives of those in the community." Now, this is a proposal that the Bloomberg administration has supported in the past. As a matter of fact, at a 2007 city council hearing, former transportation commissioner Iris Weinsahl said, quote, "If helmets can prevent many or even some bicycle fatalities and injuries that occur, why would we not take the next step and mandate them for all users?" Helmets are now required for those under the age of 14 when riding a bike in the entire state of New York. But a few months later, Ms. Weinsahl was leaving her job as Transportation Commissioner, soon to be replaced by Janet Sadiq Khan. Ms. Sadiq Khan had a different view and decided that a mandatory helmet law was not a good idea, and Taking Ms. Sadiq Khan's view, Mayor Bloomberg has now rejected Councilman Greenfield's proposal. Speaking on behalf, well, we suspect on behalf of the mayor, was Deputy Mayor Howard Wolfson last week, who said, quote, "There's a reason why no major city has imposed a mandatory bike helmet law, and that's because the best way to protect cyclists is to avoid accidents in the first place, and you do that with more bike lanes." Enlarging upon the point, he said the council member, referring to Greenfield, doesn't understand cyclists or cyclist safety. He has a long history of hostility towards cyclists. That he'd try to portray himself as a friend of cyclists is laughable. Now, I think it comes as no surprise to regular listeners of the Fredcast that personally, I am a personal helmet advocate, meaning I don't go anywhere on a bicycle without wearing a helmet. That's a personal choice, but I don't complain when other adults make the choice not to wear helmets themselves. And there's research that backs up what Greenfield is saying, while there is also research that says that forcing bicycle riders to wear helmets creates a greater perception of risk than may actually be in reality, thereby discouraging people from riding bicycles and entering into the cycling community. And therefore, what's more important is better cyclist and driver education and better cycling infrastructure within our major cities, and that making and that these steps will increase the safety of cyclists as well as increasing awareness for cyclists on the road, much more so than making bicycle helmets mandatory. And again, besides, it comes back to that same point that people were making about Mayor Bloomberg with his sugary drinks. It's not up to the government. It's not up to the state in order to tell us what we need to do to be safe. Now, of course, there are those who say, again, on the other hand, that those who don't wear helmets, should they get into an accident, cause a greater burden on the public health system. So there's positives and negatives back and forth. But what was interesting in this entire debate was the additional little piece of the puzzle. And that is that coming up in the next couple of months, the city of New York will begin to deploy stations for their new bike share system within the city. Should bicycle helmets become mandatory for all people riding bicycles within the city, then that would certainly pose a bit of a barrier and a problem for the success of the new bike share system. So one has to be left to wonder whether or not that figured into the mayor's decision to reject Councilmember Greenfield's proposal. Coming down perhaps on the extreme side of the issue is Scotland's leading cycling lobby group called Spokes, which announced in its recent bulletin to members that it will no longer support, advertise, or promote charity rides or other events that require participants to wear a helmet. The group is also calling on official bodies such as police and Cycling Scotland to use a mix of helmeted and unhelmeted pictures of cyclists whenever they show them in their advertisements or other literature. They're also asking for helmet manufacturers and bike shops to make it clear on boxes and in sales literature the exact risks that are associated, the possible risks associated with wearing a helmet, and the level of safety afforded by bicycle helmets. The group is careful to point out that there are situations in which a well-fitted bicycle helmet will protect the rider against injury, but that there are other incidents where it might actually increase the chance of injury. They also point out that some cyclists wearing helmets tend to engage in slightly riskier or even much more greatly riskier activity than they would if they were not wearing a helmet, how helmets can cause or worsen head injuries, and that they also point to the research that I know we've talked about here on the show before that indicates that when drivers see a rider with a helmet, they tend to assume that that the helmeted rider is safer and will therefore get closer to a helmeted cyclist than they would to a non-helmeted cyclist. As a result of all of this, and in the interest of balance, the group is no longer going to provide any support to rides that require helmets. Now, I've got to say, while I understand where they're coming from, we talked previously before about the nanny state, and I think that this is the group's sort of retribution against the nanny state, or at least a reaction to what they perceive as the encroachment of government and pseudo-government and others on the freedom of choice and the balancing of risks and benefits. While I understand all of that and I laud that at the same time, as someone who has participated in a great many number of charity and other rides, as somebody who has also helped to plan those types of rides, I have to say I disagree with them. I believe that when you get involved in a ride like that, you are talking about riding in large groups of people, very few of whom you actually know, and whose abilities and skill levels vary greatly, and that the additional protection that a helmet can provide can definitely help keep people safer. In addition, I also understand, and this perhaps maybe only goes for the states, so I don't want to impose my American experience on others, but at least here, good luck getting local municipalities, police agencies, and most importantly, insurance companies to countenance a ride that has hundreds or perhaps thousands or even tens of thousands of participants if you don't make the wearing of helmets mandatory. Now, we may not like that. There are plenty of people who I know listen to the show who don't believe that it's necessary to wear a helmet. And again, that's your choice, and I defend your right to make that choice. However, there are business decisions that need to be made as well when it comes time to planning these types of rides. And sometimes, whether the organizers of the ride believe in helmet compulsion or not, if they want that ride to actually happen on that day, the only way it's going to happen is if the insurance company and the municipalities and the police agencies countenance the ride. And the only way that they're going to do that right now is by making helmets compulsory for all of the riders. So I understand where Spokes is coming from, but I think that what they're ending up doing is they are hurting some of their own supporters, and I think that they're hurting some of these very important causes that put together group rides. And I think that there may be a better way to go about doing this. But those are my thoughts. I'm happy to hear yours. Well, no one's perfect, and I have to say that I definitely fall into that category, because while I believe in bringing product recall information to you as quickly as possible, it seems that one slipped between the cracks, and for that, I apologize. Thanks to listener Dave, I want to let you know about a product recall that occurred a few weeks ago, and this is for Chariot bicycle trailers and bicycle trailer conversion kits manufactured by Thule Child Transport Systems, also called Chariot Carriers of Calgary, Canada. Now, these are the kinds of child carriers that you can hitch onto the back of your bicycle. And about 44,000 of these were made. And the problem here is that the trailer hitch mechanisms can crack and break, and that might cause the trailer to detach from the bicycle, and that would pose an injury hazard to children in the bicycle carrier. Now, these were sold on various websites and throughout bicycle stores nationwide from December 2005 through August 2010 for about $400 $25 all the way up to about $925. Also recalled are the bicycle trailer conversion kits that would presumably take what was probably a baby jogger and convert it to a bicycle trailer. These were sold from through August 2011 for about $40 to $70. All of these were manufactured in Canada. Obviously, stop using these right away. Double check the website. I've got a link to the Consumer Product Safety Commission website where you can find full details and information on the recall. Please go ahead and check it out, www.thefredcast.com, and this is show number 191. As you can imagine, preparing a show like the Fredcast, I run across hundreds and thousands of bits of information, news stories, and studies every week, much of which surrounds, to be honest with you, and quite tragically, surrounds deaths of people on their bicycles in various situations, bicycle bombs in Afghanistan, people getting run over by trucks and buses on streets, drive-by shootings is the one that just happened in Los Angeles where the shooter was just coincidentally on a bicycle and shot a small child lying in his father's arms. So some of that I don't bring to you because, quite frankly, what does a bicycle bomb have to do with the Fredcast other than the fact that there was a bicycle involved, right? Well, I ran across a study recently which I found to be really interesting, and I thought I would share it with you. The study was as a result of a presentation given recently in Chicago at the Association for Psychological Science and given by Dr. Peter Aiton from London, England. And the study that he was presenting is one that looks at so-called dread risk. Imagine, for example, that a human is exposed to a traumatic, although low probability, event, and that as a result of that traumatic event, the person makes certain choices about what kinds of activities he or she will engage in the future. Let me give you a more concrete example. Think of the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001 here in the United States. Millions, billions perhaps, of people witnessed on their television live or on tape the traumatic events of airplanes flying into the World Trade Center and the traumatic events that occurred as a result. Well, it comes as no surprise now, so many years later, that we understand that there were people who made the decision as a result of seeing what happened not to travel via airplane. And the aviation industry here in the United States was dramatically affected by that, causing a great downturn and a lot of layoffs and firings in the aviation industry among pilots and flight attendants, mechanics, etc. So here were people who were dreading a risk, and as a result, and the risk was relatively low probability. How many other events like that have we seen? We've had the terrorist attacks in Spain, the terrorist attacks in London, but how many other events have we seen like 9/11, where terrorists took control of an airplane, causing great loss of life and property? Yet, because that was, even though that was a low probability event, people made a decision based on that event. And as a result, interestingly enough, there was an increase in traffic fatalities as a result because people traded airplanes for cars. Well, what Dr. Aiton looked at was, did the transit attacks in the city of London have a similar effect on Londoners? And interestingly enough, what he found was that there was a drop in the use of public transportation in favor of the use of bicycles. And this is how this links to the Fredcast. Driving in London, as you may know, is, well, it's quite congested and it's quite expensive. Parking it comes at a premium, and therefore the price is considerably higher. Plus, there's a congestion fee. You pay a certain amount of money, I think it's £8, simply to drive into central London each day. And so while people decided that there was a relatively low probability of more attacks on the London subway system and transit buses, nevertheless, they decided that they wanted to avoid those modes of transport and decided to ride bicycles instead. As predicted by Dr. Ayton, subway traffic did indeed drop as predicted, and bicycling did increase. And unfortunately, so did bicycling casualties. He found that there were 214 more casualties in the months immediately after the attacks than in the same time period prior to the attacks. Now, I'm no student of psychology, but I find the entire concept of dread risk intriguing. I know people who moved out of Manhattan as a result of the 9/11 attacks, while I also know people who lived two blocks from the World Trade Center who could see the World Trade Center towers from their apartment and looked at them every single day. And yet, once they were allowed to move back into their apartment, they did just that. So here were people who decided to leave Manhattan and people who decided to move right back into the same spot. Across the country in Los Angeles, I know people who decided to leave the city of Los Angeles because they were concerned that Los Angeles was a potential target. And people who decided to, well, leave big cities entirely and move to small towns in order to avoid the possible risk. Again, low probability, though, that it is, they decided to make that choice. Now, on the other hand, Ayton says that it's entirely possible that the drop in air traffic after 9/11, or pardon me, the drop in passengers on airlines after 9/11 might just have been because people were inconvenienced by the added security measures on airlines. And similarly, it may have been the same thing in London. As security increased in the subways, people decided they didn't want to use that mode of transport anymore. It's also possible, he says, that the jump in traffic fatalities in the United States was only in the Northeast United States, and that it coincided with an increase in alcohol and drug-related citations. In other words, it's possible that the jump in traffic fatalities had nothing to do with dread and risk aversion, and more to do with simply heightened stress leading to more substance abuse, leading to impaired driving, leading to traffic fatalities. But then he's left with a bit of a conundrum, because while it's possible to conclude that it was not dread risk in the United States, but more likely unhealthy choices that led to the increase in fatalities, but that doesn't explain the London case, in which it looks like dread risk led to an increase in cycling, which then led to, unfortunately, an increase in cycling injuries. Like with many studies similar to this one, it sounds like additional study is needed. Hopefully, Dr. Ayton and others will be able to do that without the aid of additional traumatic events like those of London, Spain, New York, and elsewhere. I found the study fascinating to consider that a risk of dread might have led to an increase in cycling. Because for me, cycling, when I have a stressful day, when I have something on my mind, when I'm worried about something, the thing that gives me the best relief for any of that is to get on my bike and go for a ride. There's a Rush lyric that I like to quote fairly frequently. And while I think it's either about running or motorcycling, it fits with bicycling as well. And it says, "You get all squeezed up inside like the days were carved in stone. You get all wired up inside and it's bad to be alone. You can go out, you can take a ride. And when you get out on your own, you get all smoothed out inside and it's good to be alone. And maybe, just maybe, if we can take the results of a study like this and realize the effect that our concern about and our dread of risk and the effect that it has on us, if we can turn that around and simply maybe get out on our bike, get out on the road, get all smoothed out inside, maybe it will ensure that we're no longer making, as Dr. Ayton said, those unhealthy choices. And maybe it will allow us to make better, more informed, more reasoned choices, especially in the face of events which are of low probability. So that's my take of the study. I'm curious to know if you had another take. I'm also curious to know your thoughts about how this relates to cycling. Feel free to send me an email or send me a voice message. I just found the entire subject fascinating. Well, speaking of psychology, here's a story about trust, lies, swindlers, and the kind-hearted nature of cyclists. This was originally reported on the Bike Portland website over the weekend, where they reported that there was an Australian man cycling through Oregon who found himself with a bit of bad luck. He said that his rear wheel had been badly damaged after being hit by a van, and that when he was stopped at a rest area trying to repair his wheel and perhaps to use the restroom, someone stole one of the bags off of his bike, and that's where his ID and his wallet and his passport were, and that he was hoping to be able to get from Portland to Seattle to get to the Australian consulate to try to get his ID replaced. And this cyclist, who was going by the name Ian, indicated to several cyclists who stopped to help him that he needed their assistance. Well, one cyclist who stopped to help Ian put out an appeal on a local community website and message board, and as a result, the following day, we're able to get Ian a new wheel, give him a little bit of money, help him replace his bike, and set him out on the road. Well, the story sounded awfully familiar to another, several readers of the Bike Portland blog. Reader Gary indicated that this sounded very familiar to him as well, saying that he had helped out somebody who looked a lot like Ian and had a very similar story about 9 or 10 years ago. This guy promised to pay Gary back, and of course he never heard from him again. Dave said that he had a similar situation in Arcata, California. Pat said 9 or 10 years ago, she ran across a similar guy, also in Portland, with sort of a similar story as well. And the stories went on and on and on and on, with some of these people saying that they had seen this gentleman 2 and even 3 times, telling similar stories each time and reaching out to other cyclists for assistance. I think there's 2 ways of looking at this story, and indeed so do the folks at the Bike Portland website. They conclude their article this way, saying, quote, "This story doesn't discount the admirable generosity many folks have displayed toward a stranger and fellow rider in need. Reader Jake Rosenfeld, who gave $100 to Ian after hearing about him through the original poster, Chad, put it this way. As I read the article, I was surprised I didn't feel more dismay about the loss of the $100 that I donated. It was help that was asked for and help that I gave. In the grand scheme of things, I've done far worse by better people. This won't affect one bit the help I choose to give in the future." Chad, the original poster, says, "In the end, I think I'd rather get slightly burned for whatever generosity I'm willing to lend than to never open up to strangers seemingly in need. One of the many pleasures of bike touring is all the interesting people you meet. Ian is certainly interesting. It's just too bad he's not honest." And I think that that's the other edge of the sword. Certainly we want to be careful, and at the same time we want to be helpful. For those of you on the West Coast, it sounds like Ian makes his way up and down the West Coast all the time. That doesn't mean that you should be skeptical of everybody who comes to you in need of a tube or a wheel or maybe a place to crash for the night or the need of the use of your phone. But I think you need to be careful. And it really is too bad that Ian is dishonest and is taking advantage of the generosity and the kind-heartedness of those cyclists who stopped to help him. And lastly, in the general news section this evening, it's a case of do as I say, not as I do, as we're familiar with politicians constantly trying to tell us what we should and shouldn't do, and trying to impose more and more rules to hopefully keep us safe from ourselves and from each other. Well, it seems that Lord Mayor Robert Doyle of Melbourne, Australia, needs to take a little bit of that advice to heart, because you see, he's found himself recently apologizing after his official car that he uses as Lord Mayor of Melbourne was involved in a dooring incident with a local cyclist. The cyclist was thrown about 3 meters and landed on the hood of the mayor's car after being clipped by the rear passenger door. And it appears that it was Mr. Mayor Doyle's wife, Emma Page Campbell, who opened that door, not realizing, and I love the use of that in the story, not realizing that a cyclist was approaching, because of course, had she taken half a second to turn her head and look before she opened that door, she would not, of course, have doored the cyclist outside the National Gallery of Victoria. Mayor Doyle said, quote, "We are very sorry this has happened. We hope the cyclist recovers quickly," following up with, "It does show how careful we all have to be in sharing our roads." A good point, Mr. Mayor. I think that from now on, I'm hopeful that you will be the shining example of sharing roads with cyclists. Well, let's move on to professional racing. And when last we met here on the Fredcast, I told you about Dave Zabriskie winning yet another red, white, and blue jersey as the national time trial champion here in the United States, and letting you know that the road race title was still up for grabs. And this year, the road race title was won by Tim Duggan of Boulder, Colorado, and Team Liquigas Cannondale, holding off a charging pack and a chasing group of about a dozen riders last Monday to win the USA Cycling Professional Road Race Championships. Now, Duggan's break began about 15 miles from the finish to win the 112-mile road race in Greenville, South Carolina, in 4 hours, 17 minutes, and 40 seconds. Second place went to Frank Pip, and Kiel Rajanen came in third place. Our time trial national champion Dave Zabriskie finished in 14th, and George Hincappy, a local favorite, came in 16th place. Now, one other note, we talked in the last show about my confusion about why it is that we're doing the National Road Racing Championships and National Time Trial Championships immediately coming off of the Tour of California, arguably the United States' largest professional race. And so we had a lot of racers who were in recovery mode following that race, obviously not Dave Zabriskie because he seems to perform quite well, and also during the running of the Giro d'Italia. Now, clearly the Giro finished on Sunday, and the road title was on Monday, Memorial Day. But nevertheless, it seemed to me at the time that it didn't make any sense that we were right in the middle of the season when it was going to be inconvenient or indeed impossible for some of America's best road cyclists to attend this championship. And I told you that I was going to consult with my friend Neil Brown. Neil was actually doing the commentary for the live video streaming of the race. Neil telling me that the problem is USA Cycling wanted the U.S. National Championships to coincide a little bit more with the time of year when the Europeans do their championships. And as a result, this seemed like the best time of year to do the race. Despite that, however, and I argued with him, I still think it's a dumb time of year to do a race. I think that some of our best professional cyclists simply were, and by the way, Tim, I'm not diminishing what you've done, but look, folks, let's face it. Tim Duggan does not have the greatest palmares out of all American cyclists. If you put his accomplishments next to the likes of, well, a Levi Leipheimer, perhaps, Or how about a Taylor Finney, even in his short career? I just think that we didn't have our complete lineup of the best American cyclists in this race. And so when I mentioned that to Neil, Neil's comment was, okay, Dave, when do we do it? And again, it's tough. It would seem to me that the best time to do it might be in the fall, perhaps a month or so after the Vuelta, or perhaps in the winter, or before, or maybe just after the Tour Down Under. In each of these cases, the cyclists either are or can be in good shape, and they're not distracted by major international races bookending or going on simultaneously with this event. So not diminishing what Tim has done, he rode a great race and clearly outclassed the field, many of whom are far more experienced and far more accomplished, if you will, racers, professional racers on the international circuit. So not diminishing what Tim did. I just believe that if we're going to have a national championship, that all of our elite racers should be in attendance. Meanwhile, on the world tour scene, we are in the midst of the traditional prologue to the Tour de France, the Critérium du Dauphiné Libéré, taking place from June the 3rd through June the 10th, the 3.54-mile individual time trial of the prologue of the Dauphiné Libéré was won by Luke Durbridge of Australia, second place going to Brad Wiggins, third to Andre Greivko, fourth to Carlos Barreto, and fifth to Tony Martin. Stage one was won by last year's Tour de France winner, Cadel Evans. It was 116.2-mile road stage, Cadel winning it in 4 hours, 36 minutes, and 21 seconds. And stage two today was won by Daniel Moreno from Team Katusha, with the final general classification as of the end of stage two. And of course, the race concludes this weekend, showing Brad Wiggins in first, followed just 1 second back by Cadel Evans and Andre Greivko, with Carlos Barreto 2 seconds back and Tony Martin 4 seconds back. Interestingly, Andy Schleck is looking to be in bad form at the moment and not getting a lot of sympathy from team director Johan Bruneel, although there are a lot of people who are wondering whether or not Andy is actually sandbagging, either to try to take the win in the Critérium du Dauphiné Libéré, or whether this is just tactics and strategy as he works toward July's Tour de France. We'll know more by the end of the week, but Andy is not looking good at the moment. Speaking of Andy Schleck, last week Andy Schleck was presented with the yellow jersey as the winner of the 2010 Tour de France. As you'll recall, Alberto Contador crossed the finish line with the least amount of time and was declared the winner of the Tour de France in 2010, but he was then found guilty of the clenbuterol doping offense, and as a result, Andy Schleck is now in the record books as the winner of the 2010 Tour de France. Now, you'll also recall that Andy has said time and time again that this is not the way that he wants to win, quote unquote, the Tour de France. And he has said that taking the yellow jersey as a result of Contador's doping conviction would be a hollow victory. Schleck was quoted at the small presentation event last week as saying, quote, "It is 2 years after, but I will never forget this tour. It has been a very good tour. It is not the same as to take the jersey on a podium in the tour. You don't have the podium, girls. Everything around is different." Also at the presentation was tour manager Christian Prudhomme, who we've talked about on this show many times before. He was pleasant in giving the jersey to Schleck, but he lamented the amount of time it took for the case to be adjudicated, saying, quote, sports authorities must work on reducing this lag in case of cases just like this one, unquote. Now, speaking of Alberto Contador, obviously he has not been on the race circuit this year as he's finishing out his ban from professional cycling. He was not at the Giro. He will not be at the Tour. However, his ban will expire and he will be eligible to race in this year's Vuelta a España. And there are indications that Contador will be racing at the Vuelta, although he also will not be at this year's Olympics. By the way, this isn't the first time in recent memory that someone has received a yellow jersey and not on the Champs-Élysées. You'll recall that Floyd Landis was stripped of his victory in the 2006 Tour de France for his positive doping test, and the yellow jersey was then given to Oscar Pereiro. Interestingly enough, you'll also recall that Bjarne Riis, who won the 1996 Tour de France, later admitted that he won it using the performance-enhancing substance EPO. And having made that admission, he was initially removed from the official record books of the Tour de France, although he didn't have to give up his yellow jersey. However, in July of 2008, he was put back into the record books, although with an asterisk indicating notes about his use of doping to win the 1996 Tour de France. Just two upcoming races to tell you about. June 9th through the 17th, we'll see the Tour de Suisse. And then, following the conclusion of the Tour de Suisse and the Critérium du Dauphiné Libéré, it will be time to start preparing for our annual July marathon. It's the Tour de France, June 30th through July 22nd. Well, that's going to do it for the news on this week's episode of the Fredcast. Just have a short features section for you this week with a couple of comments from fellow listeners. The first one comes to us from a listener in Southern California. You may recall that last week I sort of lamented a little bit about the bicycle-friendly city and bicycle-friendly states list that seemed to come out from all quarters. We get them from IMBA, we get them from the Bike League, we get them from Bicycling Magazine. And, every time I see these lists, I wonder whether or not they're lists that I should be covering, because I'm a bit skeptical about the validity and the usefulness of the lists. And for the most part, I got a lot of support for that sentiment. So pretty likely you probably won't be hearing those here on the show in the future. However, this listener who called into the Fredcast listener hotline had a good reason why one might want to pay attention to these lists. Give a listen.
Hi, this is Josh from Southern California, and I was just finished watching or listening to your recent podcast regarding the top 10 lists or top 50 lists and so on for cities and states for bicycling. To me, in terms of opinion of the list, I don't have much of a need for it. I don't think that list is going to cause me to leave sunny Southern California, but it may be interesting if I were to go on travel to, say, Minneapolis. That was a place, until you mentioned it, I had never thought it was really good for bicycling at all. So maybe a list like that might help travel, in the sense that if I was already going there or was thinking about a couple areas, that list might be able to target into one, in which I might not only want to go, but might also want to drag a bike with me. So anyway, love the show. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Hey, Josh, thanks so much for your call and for your message and for your thoughts. It's something I hadn't considered before, and shame on me for not doing it, but it's a really great point. You might be thinking about, hey, I got a business trip. I'm going to be in Minneapolis for two. Oh, I'm never going to go riding there. It's going to be awful. Oh, look, they're on this list. Hey, you know what? I'm going to bring my bike with me. I think that that's a great point. And one of the reasons why, as I occasionally travel around with my bike, I'm bringing you the Travels with Fred segments, because I think that it's important to be able to know if you're going to travel to a certain place, whether you're there on vacation or for business or whatever the reason, you want to know whether or not it's someplace that you might want to ride your bicycle. So it's a great point and a great reason why one might want to refer to these lists. Next up, I had an email from listener Harold. Now, Harold is a listener to both the Fredcast and the Spokesman. And it seems like, certainly here on the Fredcast, I tell you all the time, be good cycling citizens. Present a good face for cycling when you're out there in the community so that we're not constantly hearing about those scofflaw cyclists who run red lights and who run stop signs and things like that. And we've been talking about that a lot on the Spokesman as well. And I believe that it may have been as a result of the Spokesman why Harold wrote in. And he said he wanted to bring up something that he thought might be interesting and informative to his fellow listeners. He said, the next time anyone complains about scofflaw cyclists, ask them how they feel about motorcycles and their riders. Likely, the same people who abhor cyclists will be fairly neutral with regard to motorcyclists. If you ask them why, they probably won't have a good answer, but the answer is simple and fairly obvious. Even though motorcyclists flout traffic laws with far greater abandon than bicyclists, I speak from experience because I'm from both camps, he says, motorcyclists won't be the subject of motorists' ire for one reason. Motorcyclists rarely, if ever, slow motorists down. Motorcyclists don't impinge on a car driver's sense of entitlement to get from A to B with little to no fuss, but since cyclists move slower, they do. The ironic part to that is that cyclists will fuel that ire even if they're going the speed limit or faster. And as an example, he gives the Mandeville Canyon doctor, the one who slammed his car, forcing the cyclist to go through his rear window. We've talked about that a lot here on the Fredcast. We all need to keep in mind, motorists and cyclists alike, that we are not our respective enemy. Discourtesy is. If we each considered the other's perspective when we were in or on our vehicles, most of the animosity between the two groups would disappear. I know that I am preaching to the choir, but inspiration is hard to rein in. Best regards, Harold. Harold, great points. I think it's interesting to note that you're right. Motorcyclists rarely get the kind of anger from motorists that cyclists do. I know that if I've ever been riding in heavy traffic, and of course, if the cars are stopped, there's still room for me to continue on my way without stopping. Yet I get yelled at, and even though I'm following traffic laws, and you're right, I engender the ire of the motorists. While you think about the similar situation with a motorcyclist, certainly say on LA freeways where this happens all the time, and they're dodging in and out of lanes, and I'm completely stopped at a full standstill, and the motorcyclists are going 20, 30 miles an hour and making their way home a lot faster than the rest of the other commuters, yet they're not getting the same kind of anger from the motorists that we do on bicyclists. Great point, and I think your last paragraph is most important. Our enemy is discourtesy, and if we consider each other's perspective, that will go a long way toward engendering harmony. And lastly, I want to tell you about something that came to me through an email from a listener that sounds really cool. And in a way, I'm giving you a bit of a sneak peek and an ability to get your name in as a possible participant before this event is released and announced to the general public. What I'm talking about is a new ride coming up in August of next year, August 18th through the 24th, 2013. And this is an event called Cycle Greater Yellowstone. So much along the lines of a Ragbri, the Register's annual Great Bicycle Ride Across Iowa. This is a multi-day event that will take you in and around and through the Greater Yellowstone area, arguably one of the more beautiful parts of the United States and perhaps indeed the world. This sounds like a great bike tour. Let me read you from their website. We're putting together one of the most epic bike tours on the planet. Spectacular scenery with support and amenities like an all-inclusive resort. More food than you can probably eat, primo camping spots, live entertainment every night, hot showers, 1,000+ fellow travelers to ride, hoist a beverage and share stories with, a series of welcoming host towns vying to be your favorite new place, And all of this in one of the most rugged and beautiful places on earth. Now, I've put a link in the show notes to the little sneak peek website that was emailed to me. And if you go there, you can get yourself on the list and get a head start on open registration, which they've scheduled for this month. So I put myself on the list because it sounds really great. It's not too far from home and it sounds like a ride I would love to do. If this sounds like something that would interest you, it doesn't cost you anything, it wouldn't hurt, get yourself on the list too. And for those of us who end up doing it, it would be great to maybe do it in Fredcast kit, but certainly to meet up. Go ahead and check it out. This sounds like another one of those bucket list events, and I'm hoping that this one happens and that it becomes an annual event and something that is just one of those things that cyclists from all over the world want to do before they're no longer able to be on two wheels. It sounds really great. Check it out. It's the Cycle Greater Yellowstone Ride. And with the close of our feature segment, I want to take this opportunity to remind you of our show sponsor, Jensen USA, at jensenusa.com/thefredcast. You go to Jensen USA and you're going to be able to find a great selection of products at unparalleled prices with some of the best customer service you've ever experienced. Go to jensenusa.com/thefredcast or go to thefredcast.com and click the Jensen USA link. On the right-hand side of the page, this week they're showing their Kenda Tires clearance event where you can save 30, 40, 50% or more on all Kenda tires. Go ahead and check it out, jensenusa.com/thefredcast. We thank them for their support, and we thank you for your support of Jensen USA. Hey, if you'd like to contact me here at the Fredcast, just like Josh and Harold and others did, please use any one of the following methods to do so. I would love to get more of your voices on the show, so please give a call to the Fredcast listener hotline at area code 661-513-FRED. That's area code 661-513-3733. If you don't want to make a toll call or you're running out of minutes on your cell phone, go ahead and send me an MP3 WAV or AIFF file via email. Our email address is thefredcast@gmail.com. Of course, for everything going on with the Fredcast, don't forget to visit our website frequently. The website is www.thefredcast.com. And of course, to follow along with everything that's going on Fredcast related, follow me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is quite simply Fredcast. And with the contact info out of the way, there's only one thing left to do, one of my favorite parts of the show. It's time for PodSafe Cycling Music. And this week's PodSafe Cycling Music was chosen specifically for the Fredcast by IndoorCyclingMusic.com, the home of the free weekly featured track and premium members content of weekly 30 and 60 minute cardio mixes and monthly 90 minute cardio mixes to get the world moving. Get more information at www.indoorcyclingmusic.com. This week's PodSafe Cycling Music is called Who Are You? And it's by the Technicolors. Before we get there, I just want to thank you for listening. Thank you for staying subscribed. And thank you for telling your friends and colleagues and club members and team members and siblings and parents and dogs and cats about the Fredcast Cycling Podcast. I love doing the show for you. We'd love to have more of you listening. So go ahead and tell your friends. But thanks so much for listening. It is great to have you along for the ride. I'll be back very shortly with another episode of the Fredcast. But between this show and the next, enjoy the music, but most of all, enjoy the ride.